Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
Welcome to another edition of your favourite podcast. But before we get into it, we got to do a bit of admin. But it's good admin because it's bringing you gifts. Got to big up my radio show, which is over on Islington Radio. islingtonradio.co.uk. Get on them immediately. It's a fantastic new radio show that's coming your way. It's already out there. We're building it. I've got my own show on there, the Tuned Up Time Machine. There's some fantastic other people on there that you need to get on. It's brilliant. And my show is really brilliant. It's so eclectic. There is something for everybody. I'm telling you now, it's one of the best radio shows you would have ever listened to. So get on it. Thank you. islingtonradio.co.uk. Also, we've got some more five-star reviews. Now, I'm not patting myself on the back here. I'm not being big-headed and arrogant. I'm just really pleased that people love what we do. And I'm telling you now, thank you, Mr. Moo 715. Like getting a big hug from your dad. Oh, that's lovely. That's the territory I'm moving into now. I'm moving into that kind of everyone's dad. Like, you know, it's a nice place to be. I like that. I'll take care of you. You come and listen to the podcast and I'll take care of it. Don't you worry about that. It's like getting a big out from your dad. Thank you, Mr. Moo 715. We've also got Joe Girly Joe, 100% recommend. Thank you, Joe Girly Joe. Really appreciate that. Apparently I mentioned these podcasts on another podcast that I was on. And that's how you do it. That's how you do it. You've always got to advertise your stuff so people know it exists. Jim Harrett, great podcast. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, mate. Danny P40, love it. Yes, Danny P40, and I love you too. Thank you so much. Thank you to everybody. And also, we're doing a thing. If you like a particular episode, then drop us a line. Drop us a line, and we'll either hook up, and I'll have a chat with you, and we'll put that chat out. Or we can do a voice recording. We had Mia did it for us. She sent us a voice recording, and we put that out. She was just telling us about her favourite episode, which is the one with Mark Steele. So if you want to do that, like I say, we can hook up and we can record our little chat. That's for our Patreons. So if you want to do that, become a Patreon. It's only like a couple of quid a month. It's only a couple of quid a month. That's what it's not even a week. It's a month, and you get little gifts like that. So do that for us. Become a Patreon. If you can't afford to do that, then like, subscribe, and tell your friends. And that is the end of the admin. Phew! This week's guest. Let's get on with it. The podcast. This week's guest is neuroscientist and humorist Dr. Dean Burnett. Dr. Dean Burnett is also an author. He's got a new book coming out called Psychological. And I've had a brief look, I've had a bit of a skim, and it's brilliant. It's one of those where, yes, he's a doctor. It's like when we had Dr. Shahom Das, who was on a few months ago. It's like that. Yes, they're doctors, but they talk to you in a way that you understand. It's not, there isn't all this mumbo jumbo and science speak, you know. Like, I really tried to read A Brief History of Time, but I really tried, and it's probably just me. Probably people listen to this going, oh, it's easy, you don't know what's wrong with you. I couldn't get my head around a lot of stuff, whereas Dr. Dean Burnett, he really puts things in like layman's terms, if you will, and I couldn't wait to get him on. And so it's a great chat. He's a wonderful human being. He's also, his other books were The Idiot Brain, The Happy Brain, and Brain Yapping. It's fantastic. It's exactly what we needed to do. And so we got him on. So coming up in a little bit is Dr. Dean Burnett.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A podcast from producer Paul.co.uk.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Yeah, good. It's wonderful to have you on.
Thank you very much. I've been listening to the podcast while doing my morning walks this week, and it's just really good.
Oh, so it's, fantastic.
It's really
fantastic.
Nice to hear.
I've been reading up on you. It's going to be great. We're going to have a great chat.
I was a bit ominous when someone says that.
No. I've been looking at your stuff. I've been looking into you.
Window.
No, it's great. It's great. The brain fascinates me.
Seems to be a common thing, yeah.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean? There's things that, because it does things that you don't even know, you didn't even know you were going to do. Like, especially when I've done comedy, sometimes I'll say something and I'll make myself laugh because I didn't even know I was going to say it.
Oh, absolutely. Those are often like the best ones I found. I mean, I've done stand up myself like for over like 14 years. I don't do it anymore. Well, no one does it right now. I don't. But it was never more than a hobby. But. People I spoke to said, the best jokes are the ones just come to you on stage, just out of nowhere.
And you're, is it the Garu Valley?
Garu Valley.
I remember doing one of my first gigs in Blengarru.
Blengarru? Oh, yes. Come on, really? How was it?
I don't know, because you said it's like it was the end of the road.
Absolutely, yeah. It's literally end of the road. It's the valley, yeah.
And that,
geographically dead end. I know
it is. I remember I'd never been that up there before. And the whole village had their own, they had their own currency.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, they were called time credits or something like that.
My mother was... one of the main organisers of that charity. It was a regeneration project. The creation project to regenerate the valley. It was going really well until we had the Olympics, and then they decided that they should redirect all funding to London to build more flats, which was a bit of a pill to swallow.
Yeah, of course it is.
I've got friends who did that gig too, and they were like, that was wild, man. That was like a whole other different world up there. And it is, yes. I didn't realise until I left. So
yeah.
Nice to have that in common. Yeah.
They were a beautiful bunch of people. I remember I had to bring my youngest son with me to one of the gigs when I went back and did it again, and they were so lovely. They set up a little chair for him, and he got him a drink and some crisps. Oh, and
very family.
It was lovely. It was really. I've got a lot of love for Wales, and I've said this on other episodes. It's such a beautiful place.
It can be, yes. It's like it's got some really nice. It's one of those things where you don't really appreciate it until you realise. Not everywhere is like this, I suppose. Again, Valley Boy in terms of didn't travel far as a kid, a few package holidays. So you don't, you just assume that this is how things are. Then you travel further afield when you're older, and then really nice area I live in, isn't it? It's really, really naturally impressive in terms of the landscape and stuff. So
it is. It is. One of my, I've said that the drive, if you drive down from north to south, that drive through Wales is spectacular.
Oh, that's really nice, that, yeah. Yeah. Going through the Brecon Beacons and stuff.
That's
really,
it, yeah.
Lovely vistas there, definitely.
Oh, it's just next level. And, and I thought it was great with the pandemic that's gone on and Wales just shut the bridge. I went, no, that's it. No one in, no one out. Yeah. Let's not ruin this.
Exactly. I remember saying at the time, what we should do is have some sort of barrier on the bridge. We have to pay to come through. That would be really handy. <It's>
like, yeah.
After all this time, suddenly, at this point, that would have been a good thing. Whereas, because I used to emcee the Cardiff Students Union gig in the club they have there on the Tuesdays.
I know, yeah.
I don't want to forget, I was never good at that, but I got the gig because no one else wanted it at the time. But yeah, so it was fine, but so many acts, like the Avalon used to send them down from London, and maybe half the acts would start with, hey, how much is that bridge? Oh, good Lord. And just big like 5-minute rant about how expensive the bridge is, which is a valid complaint, but A, everyone starts with that, and B, these are all students. They don't pay their own bridge tolls. Most of them enough cars at the time. They don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And we were, and there was. I remember there was that old joke saying, "Oh, Wells isn't. It's they think it's so great you have to pay to get in, and blah 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 blah, and all that rubbish." Mm. But Wales is beautiful. And worth the entry fee.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But it's gone now anyway. So
yes.
Don't worry about it.
Now it's free. What did you start? What got you interested in what you're doing? How did you become a doctor?
It's a tricky one in that I've been talking about this recently, and I think, again, I'm not from an academic background, so it's a valid question. That my father was a landlord of the pub we grew up in, small Welsh community, very isolated, very ruralish, sort of tiny little village. You've been there,
Yes.
It's a very, very small community, and it's kind of self-contained, and everyone's in each other's pockets and stuff. And so, but there was no academic pretensions at all. It just wasn't the done thing. I don't think, not that where I grew up is inherently. The population's not dumb or anything. It's not what you do. And I started off as a very shy, retiring kid, which confused my father, my family, no end, because the Burnets are generally quite gregarious and outgoing and things like that. Because I was always meek and retiring and insular. So, and I think I just got into sort of sci-fi. I remember watching an episode of Star Trek Next Gen and just got kind of hooked on that. So this whole thing of, cool, with science you can have robots and flashing lights and spaceships and stuff. I know it's not really how it works now. but it was sort of got me interested. It's I think just a bit of escapism because I was so shy and quiet and meek that living in a pub in a big rowdy rugby enthusiastic parties every night sort of place did sort of make me go into my shell a bit, and I escaped by science in that respect. And I actually talked about this on another podcast, the Smirch Pod Tuesday Club. Me, Dan, and Thomas and John Rain do it. And
brilliant.
It's that's how I got into science, sort of like Star Trek and sci-fi in general. But the reason I'm a neuroscientist, I credit to Robocop 2. I know, yeah.
Not even the first one.
No. Weirdly, yeah. the lesser sequel, perhaps. But I remember Robocop was a big thing when I was a kid. It was just so cool. It was like a live-action video game. In the 80s, Robocop was just badass.
And yeah, absolutely. Love Robocop. Yeah.
In school, I always talk about Robocop and playing Robocop and stuff. And then they said the sequel's coming out. They're just really excited. And I remember it's 1990. I was watching, I think it was TVAM at the time,
the show
then. And Paul Gambaccini, the film critic,
I think. Yes.
He was reviewing Robocop 2. And he hated it, as a lot of people did in hindsight. And he said it's so vulgar, it's trash, and he's got a sort of nasally voice. And he said, there's this one gratuitous scene where Robocop karate chops a brain. And that phrase just really freaked me out. I remember having nightmares about it, about someone going around karate chopping people in the brain and killing them.
Yeah.
And I sort of waked up in a sweat going, no, you can't do that to brains. And so it developed this really weird protective nature towards brains and stuff. And so Next Gen and Robocop 2, I suppose you could argue, is why I'm a doctor.
That's excellent.
The little pebbles to start the avalanche, I guess. Strange origin story, but
a lovely phrase. And it's and that was it. Because I'm the same as you. I wasn't very academic when I was growing up. I'm not saying I'm not a doctor. What I'm saying is, I wasn't interested. It wasn't until later on that I started to read things and do things on my own terms. But I wasn't around anybody that was. Nobody talked about university and things like that. It was always just get a job, off you go. So
yeah.
So then what happened? So then you just went into it further.
Yeah, well, like I say, I got to A-levels, and I was the sort of the default, the main nerdy bloke in my school. Because like, it's like, the whole stereotype of, you know, men are much more logical and rational and better at maths and stuff than women. I came to that very late. I was like in my 20s before I realised that even was a stereotype in the wider world. Because I always thought it was just assumed that the girls and women were the smarter ones. In my school, that wasn't very much the case.
Yeah, absolutely. So
it's kind of hard to, you know, even if teachers were sort of old school or that mentality, you can't prove it when the evidence, completely contrary evidence, is all around you. But I was one of the sort of the few academically inclined blokes who were the male students. And I don't know, just sort of that became my identity a bit, I guess. And yeah. I was sort of, but again, the idea of doing A-levels. I'm the first member of my family to do A-levels, to go to university, anything beyond that. So it was all very much uncharted waters for me. And I was sort of finding out as I go, which obviously was a bit of a disadvantage, but you can't really hold that against anyone else. Like I went to university, a lot of middle-class students and privately educated, and they knew how this all worked, and I didn't, and I was figuring it out. But, you know, that's just how their life went. They didn't choose that life either, so can't really begrudge them for that. And my school wasn't the most academically inclined, and because I was into it and I wanted to study, I ended up doing 4 A-levels rather than 3, because I had no social life and no connections. So they said, are you sure about this? It's really hard work. It's like, I've got nothing else to do. Leave me alone. Well, not leave me alone, but let me do it. And I think it reflects how academically inclined my school was. Like, it was a very big school. It was also, I'm not sure if it was, but it was regarded as the roughest in the area, in the sort of that region of Bridgend, South Wales area. And my school was the one that you sort of ended up in if you got kicked out of all the others.
It's like, yeah, right.
The lowest rung of, right, if you don't make it in this school, you have to either get a job or live in the woods. And that's the sort of, those are your options now.
Yeah.
But so like the school, over 1,000 students in it, definitely. So, but if you added up the year I did my A-levels, I did physics, chemistry and biology. And if you added up the physics, chemistry, biology, actually, if you add up all the science A-level students in the year I did my A-levels, you got 7. And 3 of them were me. So, because I was in all the classes, so I was half the school science output. And it got obviously mixed blessing. You know, obviously, you stand alone there in that respect. But also, if I got a bad mark on an exam, the entire school average would go down. So teachers are always very keen to help me and assist me.
Yeah, anyway.
Not break any rules, but they were like, you need any help? Are you okay? Are you managing? it was like kind of a frantic thing. Like you sort of find yourself in a weird position of power.
Yeah, it's like you're carrying this whole school on your shoulders.
Yeah, but just purely by mathematical default. If this guy fails, we've lost our science score for the year. So that's pretty bad, you know?
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I didn't realise that at the time. I thought about it in hindsight. But I thought, they must have been crapping themselves about how bad I could have done in those exams. So I wasn't the best student either. I was just the most enthusiastic in science. I was like very much a middle to higher average student. You know, I wasn't a brain box or anything. You know, just like more just dogged, I suppose.
Yeah, right, just determined. I find it, I really admire, that's the thing, it's, I used to admire, I was like, oh, how are these people so driven? It's because they really want to do what they're doing. And then I think, because I never really knew what I wanted to do. So I just kind of, I wasn't driven in any way, shape or form. But now it's like I do this and I do comedy and a radio show, and I really want to do it. So that's what drives me on.
Yeah.
And totally. That would be the same with you, with what you're doing.
Totally, yeah. The same thing, I didn't know university was a thing until I got to A-levels and teachers kept telling me about it. And so there's more school after this. You can keep going. I was like, just really intrigued by that. And I didn't have the best support in school. Not from anyone's fault apart from, the careers advisor, I told you this before, but it's very relevant in that I said I applied to Cambridge because they told me I should. I should never have gone. I would never have got in, but they told me to apply, and I got an interview. I think they were going through one of their, got to let some of the proles in. They do that every few years or so. And I got an interview, and I was absolutely baffled when I got in. I didn't know what any of this is about. But I asked my careers advisor before I left. I said, I've got an interview at Cambridge. What can you tell me about Cambridge? I've never been. I've only heard about it referenced. I think that's just that place Stephen Fry went, isn't it? That's all I know about it.
Yeah.
And, his response was, again, my careers advisor, his official response was, Dean, the only people who go to Cambridge are gays and Russian spies. That's handy. I'll see what I can do with that. Thank you.
So that there you go.
Yeah, that was the full insight I had to prepare for my interview. So didn't use it, believe it or not. But yeah. So like, I got the did my neuroscience degree in Cardiff, and I felt like, well, I'm liking this. I feel like I could go further, and but I didn't go straight into PhD. I figured, like, I want to sort of prove to myself, do I really want to do that, or am I just afraid of working? You know, am I sort of taking shelter in the safe, cozy blanket of academia, or am I genuinely interested? So I got a job after my first degree and spent a year and a half embalming cadavers for the medical school.
Oh,
so,
wow, how was that?
Well, as bad as it sounds, really. It's not, it's not fun. You know, you are actually processing, embalming, and helping cut up dead bodies all day, every day, and that's about as enjoyable as it can hope for.
How did you cope with that? I mean, I worked in a funeral parlour before, so I've worked in an old people's home, so I've seen people die, and I've been around, you know, dead bodies, and it took me a while to get my head around it. I'll be honest.
Totally, yeah. It's I guess another thing again when you have to sort of process them in, like, getting them ready for burial, I suppose, is one thing, in that it's a respectful process. You know, it's the last thing you do for them, and it's a tradition, it's a ritual.
Yes.
Whereas I had to sort of convert them into materials for students to dissect.
And
It's a really weird thing, because we have this big anatomy theatre, like 12 cadavers laid out on trays, and like the whole point of embalming them for this is that they last. They don't like rot particularly. Yes. They last for a full like 9-10 months as the students slowly dissect them and practice their surgery, practice their anatomy, and so on. So it's a very, you know, it's a deeply chemical process, and you've got to put them out there, and they're just there, like, all the time. So start of the year, the medical students would come in to practice their dissection, and we'd always lose a few. We'd always have some people saying, I just can't do this. They cannot, like, go up close to a deceased person and probe them with scalpels. And
it would be different to operating on a live person.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a whole other different, you know, that probably is scarier in terms of there's a lot more risk here. You know, you've got to do this right. But just confronting a cadaver, a dead body, is such a emotional hurdle for so many people. And people would drop out. Like, it was an essential part of the course. If you can't do it, like, and it makes sense, in that if you can't handle this, then you probably shouldn't be doing medicine. But, you know, these are people who have, it's not easy to get into medical school. It takes incredible drive and study and hard work when you're a teenager, you know, at the time of your life when that's the hardest time to focus and drive yourself, that sort of thing. So even after all they've gone through, the idea of, you know, confronting a dead body and interacting with it was just too much for them. So it does cause an incredible visceral response in your average human brain. And I've actually written about this recently for my next book, but it's how I dealt with it. So you just have to disengage. You cannot afford to think this is a deceased person who had a life and stuff. You have to just suppress it, deflect it, you know, cope with it somehow. Like, the whole gallows humor thing is definitely a valid defense mechanism. But I don't know if it had any particularly long-lasting effects on me, because I've been struggling, but I mean, delving into my own emotions this year a lot, because obviously the COVID thing, but I've talked about it openly whenever anyone asks, but my father caught COVID in March and he died in April.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, man, but he was 58. There was no prior health complications. And I wasn't there for him. I couldn't be there. My last word just said to him over a WhatsApp call. And I've had to deal with grief alone, in isolation from all my family. And it's been horrific. It's been an absolutely horrific experience. But one, I think, is important to talk about. But my only emotional reactions, by and large, have sort of like, oh my God, why did I do that? Why did I feel like that? Mm. And lots of different reasons. So cultural, developmental, the whole male stereotype, we don't do emotions, things like that.
Yes.
It goes a lot deeper than I realised. But I do wonder if it's part of this for my old job. Like, I spent 18 months interacting with the recently deceased and suppressing the emotional difficulties that caused in me. And it became sort of second nature. And it was also that, also interspersed with occasionally calling members of the next of kin to get the Everybody there is a donor. There were so many wild rumours of where we got them from. Like they're all shipped from Germany, or we scour the streets at night for homeless. It's really
like Dr. Frankenstein and his.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Like, where are you getting these ideas from? No, they're all donors. But that means when they do die, you have to call the recently bereaved and say, "We when can we get the body? So we can students cut it up." And that's not something you can really approach someone casually. You can't just go, "Hey, where is he? Bring him over." Yeah, like,
forms have been signed now. We need it.
Exactly. Yeah, like pick him up between 10 and 12. You better be in. That isn't something.
Can you get it ready?
Ugh. Yeah. So you have to then suddenly go from. I had to go from being emotionally disengaged as possible to emotionally open as possible, to be as empathetic, to be as considerate and caring, and rightly so. Obviously, there's no other way to do it. But
and did people, because sometimes the person might have said, "I want to donate my body to science," but then when it actually comes to it, the relatives don't want that to happen. Have they all agreed on it, or was there any issues where they said, "Actually, we don't want this to happen"?
Yeah, it occasionally happened. Most of the time, it had to be very by the book, because obviously that's an issue they saw come in when they did set up the whole system. So everyone who don't, like, they signed all the forms, and we always used to say, regulations were, make sure your family's aware of this.
Right.
And so, like, some people didn't. Some people wanted it, but didn't want to set anyone, so they didn't tell the next of kin until they died, and then that caused tremendous problems. I mean, sometimes we just didn't take the body. We weren't paying for it. It was like they got a free funeral process at the end of the session. That was always a tricky emotional engagement thing. So I went from being, like I say, emotionally closed off as possible for my own sake to as emotionally available as possible. And the whiplash of that is really quite...
How did it affect you in other ways?
Well, that's what I'm wondering now, because obviously my father died and my own emotions are deeply confusing for me. Like, why did I respond like this? Why didn't I do this? When he first went on the ventilator and sort of became kind of conscious that I may never speak to him again, I was just numb for a long time. And I know, speaking to people since, that's a very common thing. But is it the right thing? Is that what's meant to happen? Because obviously I'm the neuroscience guy, so I'm always probing this side of things. I'm always like, so why is that? And that doesn't seem like the best possible response to this. There should be a more healthy approach. There should be a more organic approach. It shouldn't be so, like, an experience happens and you get that test card in your head, like the little girl and the clown playing Noughts and Crosses, just rather than any particularly emotional response. And there's a reference the kids won't get. I was wondering, part of me thinking maybe it was doing that job for so long and that I got very good at controlling my emotions, very good at in the face of the most sort of visceral emotional triggers, like dealing with the dead. And that can have a harmful legacy. Like, the brain's very plastic, very flexible. It does adapt to things like that. That's why addiction is such a problem. That's why sort of mental health problems can be so enduring and so easy to relapse into them, because the brain doesn't just sit there and go wrong and then fix itself again. It say, what's happening now? Okay, I better adapt to deal with this then. Okay, I better respond to this. And it slowly but gradually, it restructures the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then I'm wondering, like, it's perhaps a bit of a fatuous analogy, but I'm wondering, when you have, like, pyjamas and you stretch the waistband out too much and it's sort of, at one point you stretch it too far and it gets all floppy and doesn't work anymore. I was wondering, did I do that with my emotional system? Did I just push it past the elastic limit when I can't actually react anymore?
That's a great analogy. You like an analogy. I read that in your
book. I'm fond of them, and people like it when I do that because it makes things slightly... Sometimes I worry... It's a good analogy. Is it right? Is it actually valid? But it's too late now. It's in the book. So.
I think it's great. And you're right. And I know from my own personal experience, having dealt with people that had just passed on and then dealing with their bodies afterwards. And first of all, you go through the realisation, like, this is going to happen to me. Mm. I'm going to die. And then you're like, oh wow, and then what happens? And it makes you question everything. And then your brain, like you say, your brain kind of takes everything, all the information you're gathering, and kind of plays with it and separates it and puts it in a place where you can function and carry on your job.
Yeah.
And so there is, I think there is, you're right. I think there is a bit of you that kind of, your brain kind of goes, well, you don't need to, don't worry about that bit now. We'll just shut that off. We'll put that in that box over there and deal with it later.
Yeah, definitely. There's going to be, again, the brain adapts. It learns how to do things it, based on what you make it do. And obviously the wider world we live in now is very stressful, and people in very different ways, especially now, but it, you know, kind of has been for quite a long time. So people will, you know, people are the product of their upbringing, of their experiences, and all of these have shaped our brain in some way, shape or form, so to produce, you know, its current state. So the way your brain's currently wired, the way it's put together, is the end result of both your genes, your biology, your development, and your general experiences, which is how people work. And, you know, if you've had negative experiences, a lot of them, then your brain's had to adapt to deal with those or to maintain a sort of baseline functioning despite them. And that's where sometimes the problems can arise, because they can adapt to wrong things. You know, if you are in an unhealthy, unpleasant relationship, your brain thinks, well, I don't want to leave this relationship because it's convenient and helpful, so I'm going to find workarounds. I'll find excuses why this is okay. I'm going to rationalize this to myself. And this is one example of, you know, it's adapting, but it's not, you know, there's no sort of grand plan in the brain. It's just doing what it needs to do to keep you going.
Yes, exactly. It's just survival, isn't it? Yes. That's a really interesting point. Because people say all the time, why'd you put up with that? Why are you in that? Why are you staying there? Why are you staying with him or her or whatever? And it's just that person is just trying to survive.
Yeah, no, it's easy to say. I've been asked a lot recently about, it's come up a lot about toxic positivity. That's something which I've written about a few times. But in the last couple of weeks, it's become a sort of hot button topic, I think. And I wonder if it's because we're entering the Christmas period and, you know, during the time of massive COVID, Brexit destruction, Trump meltdowns, and lots of bad stuff's happening whilst Christmas is going on. So you've got this jolly veneer on a layer of unpleasant world events. A lot of people are sort of responding more to the whole people, you know, just being told to be happy, be cheerful when circumstances would suggest otherwise. And like I've written about it before, but it's become, you know, people are really interested in this idea of toxic positivity, of people telling you that you need to be happy, you can control, you can choose to be happy, which isn't how it works. You know, like, happiness is great. You know, it's fine to be optimistic. It's fine to look on the bright side when that's an option. But there are plenty of times when, you know, the reality of the situation is that you shouldn't be happy about this. This is a bad thing. You shouldn't, you know, embrace this. And, or something bad's happened to you. Like, you've lost a relationship. You've lost a parent. You've lost a job. These are very unpleasant, you know, borderline traumatic things to go through. To say that you can choose to be happy about them is completely wrong. And being unhappy, being sad, being angry is a very valid and healthy response to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something which should be, you know, this seems to be a prevailing idea that happiness should be the default in the modern world. And you can blame that on social media, you can blame that on capitalism, you can blame that on the sort of aspirational marketing or whatever you want to call it, or like well-being gurus and things like that. Whatever the source is, the idea that if you're not happy, something is wrong.
Yeah.
And that isn't how the brain works. The brain isn't default happy. Happy is like a reward state for when something good happens.
Yeah, it's like extra, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, if you're happy all the time, then it essentially becomes quite meaningless, because there's no, you know, that's your default. So why do anything? You're going to be happy anyway. So I try to strive against this idea that if you're not happy, something is wrong. No, if you're not happy, you have a good reason to be not happy, then something is right. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're allowed. Yeah. I'm really struggling with this Christmas thing now. I it's like you say, it's almost like, it's like we're pretending nothing's happening. It's like, oh, it's Christmas. And I'm like, I don't feel Christmassy. And I imagine you especially don't feel Christmassy as you've lost your dad.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't, this is the last thing. We already know what Christmas really is about, you know, deep down. It's just this commercial bullshit festival. Which makes me sound like a real Grinch, but
I know, but it's valid. I guess people are. I totally understand. People are sort of like, you know what? This has been the worst possible year. It's lasted 87 months already. Let's just have the fun bit at the end. Which is what I think. That's what Christmas is usually about. You know, you can argue the whole the gift giving, the unnecessary spending, the indulgence is perhaps not needed, or can be quite a cynical vibe to it. But the whole getting together, just celebrating the end of the year, celebrating your time with each other, that's nice. And I think people do need that. But the trappings can be quite overwhelming. And again, at this particular point in time, can be quite sort of jarring with You know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, guys. It's not going to go away because you've got the day off.
Yeah.
You cook a turkey. That's not how biology works. But I can understand people wanting to feel that way or wanting to sort of embrace that helpful fiction
for
a brief period.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I should just, I should not overthink it. I think, I don't know. But that, I read in one of Ruby Wax's books, and she was talking about negativity and the reason why we err on the side of negativity, human beings, and that was our survival mechanism. And that's why a lot of it, we're negative because we're still looking around for the dangers. Like you've just said, if we're happy all the time, you don't really look, you don't take any notice of anything. You're not looking around and you'll probably get hit by a truck.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a big part of most mental health problems. It's like the stress system, the part of the brain. There's part of the brain, like the threat detection network is what the general umbrella term for it. It's like complex network of fundamental regions, including the amygdala, the hippocampus, the periocortical gray, and all those, long Latin names because scientists like to show how clever they are when when nobody's looking. And but what they do is this network does. It's not like a human thing. It seems to be a fundamental part of most brains in nature. It sort of like monitors all the sensory input your brain's receiving and flags up anything which could potentially be dangerous or a threat or even a hazard to you. Because of survival. In the wild, if the crack of a twig could be a predator. Some studies show that this threat detection network is vaguely triggered, made more active, by the sight of triangles, which sounds odd, but when you think in nature, things that are triangular, we're talking claws, talons, teeth, spikes, these are all dangerous things. So it's not like a completely big reaction. We don't run screaming if you see a kite. That's not how humans work.
But it's fascinating.
It sort of tags it. Say, okay, that's a pointy thing. So keep an eye on that. Let's have a little bit of a fight or flight response. Just tick it over the background. And the stress itself, the stress response, stress chemicals, is like a precursor to the fight or flight response. It's your brain making your body get ready for potential dangers, potential hazards. And one problem is the human brain is sort of a victim of its own success here, because most creatures can just what can I see, what can I hear, is it dangerous, yes, be afraid, if it's not, no, don't be afraid. They have a very more clear-cut relationship, whereas we've got the point now we can encompass so much of the world, of the wider environment or possibilities, that we can be afraid of things which haven't happened, which may never happen, which didn't happen. And again, we think, what if I'd cross the road a second earlier, that car could have hit me. It didn't. It literally can't do that now. That's in the past. It's a thing that didn't happen. We can still be afraid of it. What if the economy doesn't do too well and I lose my job at the company? These are things that, completely unrelated to your everyday life in terms of what you can influence.
Yeah.
But you can be afraid of them. And what if my partner's going to leave me for something people have, it's a joke, but it happens people sort of dream about their partner doing something bad and they wake up and they're angry and upset at them.
Yes.
They've done nothing. They were completely innocent of all this, but you still have that reaction to it because to you it felt real.
Your brain thinks it happened, doesn't it?
Yeah, it happened inside your brain, like everything that real does. Everything that's real ends up as brain activity in some form. So if it's imaginary, then a lot of the time the brain doesn't really differentiate that well. So we can be afraid of things which haven't happened or just may potentially happen one day.
Yes.
So we have a lot more to be afraid of, and that's why we are constantly stressed. And the brain hasn't evolved to handle long-term, chronic, low-level stress. It sort of scrambles the system a lot. And that's a lot of the literature says that's why we get depression now, because the parts of the brain which regulate mood and stuff are, in many ways, exhausted by the constant stress chemicals they have to deal with, or the constant activity. Or anxiety is like when those parts are just amplified because there's so much low-level stress chemicals and stress response, to a point where the brain adapts and they become dominant. Now, those parts of the brain which look for threats are stronger than ever because they've been worked out a lot more by constant stress and anxiety. And so this does seem to be one of the underlying things of a lot of mental health problems, particularly the neurotic ones, like your anxieties and your depressions. So.
Yeah. There seems it's funny. Nicholas Pinnock is an actor, and we had him on a past episode, and he talks about. I said to him, "How did you get over?" Because I watched a film that he'd done, and it was a really powerful, strong strong film, a real strong character. And I said to him, how did you get over that? And he said, it takes time. This is why a lot of actors have a lot of mental health issues or addictions or whatever, because the brain thinks that what they're doing is real.
Yeah, totally. And I just looked into that as well, is that I think what one of my earlier theories was that work can be so stressful, just like everyday work, you know, your job. Unless it's a job you love, like a lot of comedians find their job great, or people, you know, some people love accountancy, that's fine, whatever, each to their own. But most people have, even a job you really like will have parts you don't like, or things you'd rather not be doing, but you have to do them to get the money. But workplace stress is like the big part of burnout and, you know, just mental breakdowns and just chronic stress problems. It stems from work more often than not. And I thought, well, because in the workplace, you're like my own example sort of led to this, and you are constantly sort of, it's never explicitly stated, I think, but there's a sort of mutual understanding that you have to suppress your emotions. You can't react angrily to your boss when he gives you a dressing down for something you haven't done. You have to let the customer berate you because the customer's always right. You can't sort of call out your toxic coworker for being a prick all the time because you know, that's not professional. You know, you can't cry in the workplace. It was like 2015 when one of the apprentice candidates, one of the women that cried in the sort of the meeting room, and that led to loads of different articles and discussions of should you cry in the workplace. So it's weird that it's the place which more often than not gives you the most reason to cry.
Yeah.
The one place where you're technically not allowed to. So, like, I thought it maybe do was suppressing emotions, but when you consider that actors don't, they you know, a big part of the job is displaying emotions.
Yes.
But it's, I think it comes down to suppressing or displaying the wrong ones. Like, if you have to pretend to be in an emotional state which you're not in.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, your raw reactions are this, but for various reasons, you're compelled to display this alternative type. Like when someone's yelling at you on the phone, you know, the customer who's just, I don't know what they're talking about, but you have, they're really annoying, they're upsetting, they're giving you a lot of abuse, but you have to pretend that it's fine. You have to pretend that you're happy to deal with this. And those are the jobs that can be the most stressful and can have the most mental health problems because, you know, you're really confusing your brain and the emotional level, and it's causing so much, you know, disparity between what you're feeling and what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that can cause a lot of problems, you know, over, you know, given enough time and enough exposure.
Yeah. I think it's that it's, and I think what's happening as well now with people with, like you say, anxiety, everybody's anxious now. And I think everyone's becoming addicted to the dopamine, and that's fucking us up a bit as well, where we're scrabbling for the likes and the attention. And now we're all getting these hits of dopamine all the time, every second. And it's, that must be scrambling your brain somewhat.
It is a bit, yeah. I mean, the social media thing is an interesting one. I mean, I listened to one with Rob Rouse. I know he's very much on the social media isn't good side of the argument. And there's lots of reasons for that, and very valid ones too. But it's more of a mixed thing than in terms of the science than your pundits will really let on. It has a lot of dangers, a lot of hazards, a lot of risks. We don't know the long-term effects of social media use and internet use on the brain yet, because in practical terms, there hasn't been a long term yet. I mean,
true.
Social media is, 20 years old at most, and it wasn't even that big at the time. So let's say we've had a decade of constant use. That's not a great deal of time, you know, in terms of a human lifespan. And there are lots of different approaches to it and different ways of using it. I mean, some studies show that it depends on what you do with it. It can have very negative effects on your mental health because you are, like you say, constantly scrabbling for likes and things. And human brain is very social. We're a very social creature. So much of our brain has evolved to interact and engage with other people. But that comes with risks. You know, when you talk to someone face to face, you have to sort of maintain a regular conversation. You have to respond to what they're saying, what they're doing. You have to think about what you look like, what you sound like. It's a lot more involved. Whereas social media allows you to a lot more control over how you come across. You can pick the best selfie from 600 different samples, I don't know, and you can respond to a comment or a tweet like hours later if you want to. You haven't got to do it in real time. But it gives you the rewarding parts of interaction anyway. But it's kind of like, it is to the brain what like refined sugar is to our digestive system. We like sugar, it gives us energy and stuff, but if you just ate refined sugar and nothing else, you would be ill because it's not the same thing as what we've evolved to do. It just, it's taken out the good parts and left it's like there's no roughage to it. It clogs up the system in that respect. But there's also the upside of now there's so many people report that when you have like a mental health problem, you can go online and find someone who will relate to you, will empathize to you. And it's often a lot easier to talk to a sympathetic stranger than to someone, you know, in your own life you care
That's
about.
True.
A lot of teens can't really talk to their parents about mental health stuff because, you know, parents are too close to it. They're too involved. This too, and also the generational divide is more stark than ever. There's a quote I found in a conference I did, like, we are currently in a very unique point in history. We have a generation of digital immigrants raising a generation of digital natives. Like, parents most parents now are people who were born before the internet was a thing. And so they're still figuring out how it fits into the world. Whereas children, you know, teenagers now were born when the internet was a thing. It's never been any different then. And so they come at it from completely different angles. For them, it's like, for modern day teens, it's like, well, the internet's always been there. It's like saying, you were born before trees were a thing. That's not possible. You know, it's, but they have no reason to fear it then. It's like, it's just there. It's always been part of life. And why would we be worried about it? So, yeah. So, like, in a few generations' time, this wouldn't be an issue anymore. At least everyone would be equally familiar with the internet, I suppose.
Yes.
On any major advances.
And I think we're talking, and I think, saying that as well, I've said this as well before. We're like sort of the first generation that are talking about mental health and our feelings. Like, you know, it's been slowly happening over the years, but now there's been this explosion now where we're all talking about it, and we might not necessarily be the ones that benefit from it, but at least we're making those conversations. So I think, like you say, in a good few years' time, this won't be an issue. Everybody be talking about things. Lines of communication will be open and more and flowing, and I think that's what people need to keep in mind, that we're only just starting that journey, aren't we?
Totally. I think progress is incremental, and I think, like, I think you mentioned it in the Rouse episode, and it's been mentioned elsewhere, but the idea that if you don't have, you know, if there's a problem, and like, if I don't have the perfect solution right now, then it's not worth pursuing. That's an unhelpful viewpoint. And then I think so much of online interaction is like, I think the world should be like this, and I'm pissed off that it's not, which is fair.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's it doesn't change the fact that the world is like it is, and you have to sort of pick your battles or take your wins where you can and things like that. So, like, again, the social media does allow like a bubble where everyone agrees that the world should be like this, and anyone who disagrees is wrong.
Yeah.
And that leads to, you know, radicalization isn't really a right word, but it's a known process. There's the group polarization is a well-known phenomenon in psychology, whereby people in groups tend to be more extreme and dogmatic than if they're on their own.
Yes,
because obviously everyone reinforces each other, and they want to be the best, and they sort of take the, you know, the general consensus further and further, and so on and so on. But the mental health thing is right. I think I've seen it in my own like experiences. Like, I started writing for The Guardian in 2012, and I'd say back then, it's like, we're talking 8 years ago, but it still feels like a lifetime ago now,
yeah.
Because obviously just from 2020 alone. But there was still occasionally, you'd still see arguments or articles like saying things like depression isn't real. It's not a real thing. There's no, it's just attention seeking. It's just all that sort of nonsense. But now the arguments are far more likely to be about, well, antidepressants don't work. You shouldn't take them. It's all a scam and stuff. But so, like, that's bad. No, we're wrong. That's a very unhelpful stance to take, or pill shame. And these are all problems to be dealt with.
Yes.
But it seems like, you know, the argument against, you know, anti-mental health stuff has retreated to the point where it's accepted that depression is a thing now, far more than it ever was. You can say, like, if someone says, oh, I've got depression, it's, oh, okay. Like, that's a
yes.
thing now. It's recognised as being legitimate. Whereas maybe a decade or so ago, that wasn't necessarily the case for everyone. You still get plenty of people who don't think it's that, but that's not the consensus now, I think. That's not the mainstream norm. So there is, you know, you can see progress is happening. Still a long way to go, but stuff's occurring.
Yeah, I think people, like you say, people are starting to recognise that depression is a debilitating thing, and it's not just you feeling sad. It's that you feel despair, or you feel, I tell you, this has happened to me recently. I felt my brain was just fogged. I couldn't focus on things. My memory was shot, and I kept forgetting to, like, with us. I meant to get you on weeks ago, and it completely slipped my mind. And then I saw your thing. And I'm like, oh my god, yeah, I was supposed to speak to you. And I'm like, why is that? Why is my brain doing that? Why am I? I felt like it was like a gloved hand holding my brain, and the signals weren't coming out of it, and that was stress, and I didn't realise I was that stressed.
Yeah, that's like a thing of, I think people, when they think depression, they focus on, like I say, the sadness, the really low mood, which obviously is a big part of it, but not necessarily always. It could be people, you know, depression can manifest as flat affect, like you feel nothing, numbness. That's not sadness, but it's not good either.
It's numb, isn't it? It's nothing,
yeah. Or some people have anger, you know, low level frustration and just lash out anger. But what are the main things which separates everyday depression? Like, I'm depressed because I've lost my job. I'm depressed because of the economy. I'm depressed because of the news. Those are valid reactions, but that's not clinical depression. One of the things, like, clinical depression is a lot more intense in these, like, negative or absent moods, but it's more sustained in that you can't get out of it. It doesn't change for, like, 2 weeks. That's that's a big part of the criteria. It's not just, like, you could be sad, you know, for any number of reasons, but then something could happen which cheer you up, like a few minutes later or an hour later or the next day, or just sleep on it. These are all perfectly normal occurrences. But with actual clinical problems, you don't. Like, you can carry on feeling the same way, which is weird. The brain doesn't normally behave like that. And one of the main theories now is it's all to do with the fact that because of the constant stress, or because of whatever mechanism that contributes to or leads to or is caused by, the parts of the brain which control mood or allow you to change mood are sort of, they become exhausted. They lose neuroplasticity. The brain cannot change or adapt as well as it could. So you have, like, this, you're stuck in this negative state. And like I say, you can't, it's like a fog. You can't feel anything. Your brain's not as active, or the right parts aren't as active because they've been exhausted by what's happened to you. And that's one argument about how antidepressants work. They sort of stimulate the certain parts which, you know, downstream, which can, like pumping air into a bellows, like, you know, to get the furnace going again. Or maybe it's more like planted fertilizer in a, you know, in a wilting plant, or whatever analogy you like. And like I said, I've got lots,
but they're all brilliant. I really
thank you. But
that makes complete sense. Yes, because when people talk about antidepressants, you just get that straight away. You're like, oh, don't rely on them. It's just big pharma getting us addicted to these things, so we spend all this money and blah blah blah.
Absolutely.
But nobody has ever put it in that way that you've put it.
Well, yeah, there's. Believe me, how it works. Like, there are lots of different types now, and like more advances all the time. I mean, they've just now, in the last like year or so, approved release of like ketamine antidepressants, which is obviously. I imagine a few people get a few eyebrows raised. Like, what?
My eyebrows nearly shot through my hat.
Exactly. Isn't that a horse tranquilizer?
Yeah. Is it the other way?
That's how complex the brain is. You can have, you can be addicted to things which stimulate you and things which suppress you. You know, like heroin sort of blankets you in this weird euphoria, and cocaine is really stimulating. You can be addicted to both, and, like, you know, both are enjoyable, but they both have completely different effects.
So yeah.
The brain's really diverse like that. But the whole ketamine thing is, because the most common antidepressants, your Prozac and stuff, these are SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But they act on the monoamine neurotransmitters, like acetylcholine, dopamine, serotonin. Like, that's like the molecular class of transmitters in your brain. Ketamine acts on glutamate, which is the most abundant stimulating transmitter in the brain. So, like, 90% of all, by weight, transmitters in the brain are glutamate. It's like, so ketamine acts on, whereas, like, monoamine ones, so there's, like, the monoamine system in the brain is like a thread of, like, it's like the veins in marble, you know, like, they just, like, it's important, it's everywhere, but it's, like, a small part of the whole.
Yeah.
Whereas glutamate is, just, like, does everything. So ketamine can kick in straight away. That's why, like, some the more common antidepressants these days take about 2 to 3 weeks to kick in.
You're right.
We're not entirely sure why that is yet, because it's because that whole plasticity thing, you can't just fire them up straight away. You got to do it slow and gradually.
And your brain has to figure out what it is.
Yeah, or like you got to let that raised activity filter through to the downstream parts, which are kindling in a campfire. If you just like match one bit, it'll spread slowly. And that's why antidepressants sort of do. But ketamine is, it's more like just dousing it in petrol and just crank up the flamethrower. Right, have this. Work, you bastard. It's like, okay, this is a bit more stimulating now. So, so it tends to work pretty much like next day or even a few hours later. So,
wow.
But the reason it's not so popular right now, or not so common yet, is because I stress it's ketamine. It's not. You're activating all the brain, and you shouldn't really do that if you have the option, because that's a lot of important stuff you're just going to throw out of whack there. So,
yes.
Yeah. But yeah, like the idea that antidepressants, it's just big pharma trying to cash in. I mean, that's not how it works. Like, that's never been how it works. I mean, I'm not sure that, I'm not saying big pharma wouldn't do that.
No.
There's way too much regulation. There are way too many people who depend on and need antidepressants to function. And they're not great. And they're not perfect. I mean, they can be great for some people. They can be life-saving. But other people can have genuine negative reactions to them when they end up feeling worse. That's,
yes,
that's the beauty of the brain. Every brain is different enough to allow that to happen. You could have adapted your, like, certain parts of your brain can be dominant with others and they're not in others, which means antidepressants stimulate this part, not that part, and that causes bad things, not improvements,
yes,
and so on and so on. So yeah, it's just complex. It's an effect of how the brain works. We don't have like uniform brains, and
nor
should we. We'd all be the exact same person, and that's not helpful to anyone.
Imagine that. But it's true, but it's that assumption that you're going to start taking antidepressants and immediately you're going to feel better. And like you've said, that's not the case. These things take time to build up, and they might not even be the right antidepressants for you. Try some, and I think it's a lot of depression comes from that as well. People go, "Oh, I've got this," and then so they're like, "Oh, this hasn't worked either. What am I going to do?" And they start to spiral a bit.
Mm.
And it, you know.
That is like something I've written about in the next book, the psychological one is out. And it's, a lot of people have talked about this, but the idea that mental health and physical health problems should be treated as the same is, again, it's a double-edged sword in that if you're dealing with someone who doesn't think mental health problems are real, then yes, you should probably use that as in, because mental health problems are intangible. You can't really see them. You can't, you can't observe them. They're not obvious to the outside person. Whereas a physical health problem, you know when someone's physically unwell. If you meet someone, they've got like green slime seeping from all their pores, or like their legs pointed in the wrong direction. All right, that's bad. That's not meant to be happening. We know how the body works. You know, it looks, this looks bad. This is wrong. You can tell that this is an unhealthy person physically. You can't do that with mental health. And so to say, like, you know, when someone's mentally unwell, to say to someone who doesn't believe that's a thing, it's like when your body goes wrong, you know, your mind's going wrong. Similar thing. And you can sort of see why that example, that comparison makes sense. But when it comes to actually explaining them and like getting people to understand how they work, it can be unhelpful, because the idea that, you know, physical health problems, you can find the source. You can say, right, this is this virus, there's this tumour, there's this break. You can go in and attack that, fix that, address it, and you can be cured. Not always, like physical health problems are far more complex, but like most of the time you can't do that with a mental health problem. There is no like blob or pathogen or disruption which you can just go in, fix, and then everything goes back to normal. We're talking about, you know, sort of a flaw or an issue or just a trauma which has affected how the brain and mind is working. And it's normally to do with coping or workarounds or coming to terms with it or like processing things differently. So like, but then when you compare mental health problems to physical ones, people might expect, well, when am I going to be better? When am I going to be cured? How do you fix this? It's not fix. It's a whole different ethos, a whole different approach to it. And by not addressing that or not admitting that or not making it clear, you perhaps set up false expectations which are unhelpful when they don't occur. And when it comes to mental health problems, that can be more stressful again, which just compounds matters.
I know exactly what you're saying. And I think I've said this to someone the other day, and I was saying that because it's that they were saying, God, everyone just seems like they're mentally ill now. And I'm like, no, we're recognising that the world is tough. Life is hard. And people are now sort of recognising that. And I think a lot of it's to do with the framework that we have to live in, that this society says you have to be this kind of person to fit into this framework in order to be a decent citizen and a perfect human being. But really, we're animals, aren't we? Fundamentally.
The problem is, it comes back to the whole threat detection thing. There are still parts of our brain, like the human brain, the cortex, the top bit, which is like the most intelligent bit, which handles all the clever stuff that we do, you know, the imagination, foresight, planning, self-assessment, self-awareness, all that. That top bit, the big wrinkly bit on top, which we all recognise as the brain, that evolved, like that. All animals have that to a certain extent, but ours got like 50%, like doubled in size maybe, over the space of 3 million years, which is a ridiculously fast amount of time in an evolutionary on the evolutionary scale. It's like, that's the evolutionary equivalent of Spider-Man being bitten by the spider one morning and having powers the next day. You're like, what the hell happened there? It's like the experiment just got out of control, like wander off into the corners. Oh God, it's got out again. But that which is cool. Obviously, it gives us all these cognitive abilities we have, but the fundamental parts of the brain, the lower levels, they're the same as they've ever been. We call it the reptile brain, like the really deep parts of the brainstem, which handles all the basic housekeeping stuff, essentially keeps you alive, because reptiles have this part of the brain too. We split off as different species or different genuses of species hundreds of millions of years ago. And so again, that comes back to what I said earlier. The problem is that we have this incredibly complex society we've built up around ourselves with so many expectations in it, and all of which seem like fine in isolation. Of course you should get a job. Of course you should find someone and settle down. Of course you should, be healthy. Of course you should. Of course you should. These all make sort of individual sense in isolation. But taken together, it's a lot of demands, a lot of expectations on your average human brain.
Yes.
And, circumstances prevent us from doing a lot of them. We all say, you can be whatever you want to be if you try hard enough. No, you can't. That's just simply... The harder you try, the more likely it is. But it doesn't mean there's never any guarantees, because that's not how the world works. You can't all be astronauts. You can't all be Olympic athletes. That's just life, But we're sort of constantly telling ourselves differently, and there are so many stresses, and the fundamental parts of your brain, they don't really tell the difference between, is that a tiger coming towards me or am I going to lose my job? The chemical response, like the neurological reaction, is kind of the same.
Right.
So we end up sort of being stressed about all these things, which in physical terms aren't really that dangerous. Like when you're a teenager, it's incredibly stressful to think, shall I ask her out? For blokes especially, I don't want to be rejected. Or like they're all like on stage, like acting in front of people.
Yeah.
Or doing karaoke something, or public speaking. Unless it's a really, really tough crowd, no one's going to hurt you. Like, there's never going to be any physical damage. Yeah. But again, Jonglers is gone now, so we can say that. Not so much likely as these days. There's no physical threat there. The worst thing that happens is you're going to be rejected by people, or they're going to not like you. But that's a huge deal for our brains. We're a social species. And so we react with the same level of stress and fear and paranoia as if it was a physical threat there. Something which genuinely threatened our well-being physically.
Yes.
And the world is full of stuff like that, and that things which cause us to be stressed and anxious about it because we fear the consequences, because we have that ability. And that's where a lot of the problems arise. And now we're online all the time. Now we have news from all parts of the world. We have more things to be anxious about or to be wary of. And again, you can argue it's a good thing. Like, it's good to be aware of these things. Like, these things are important, but there's only so much your brain can handle any one go before it goes, right, I'm maxed out now.
Yes.
And then we're going to stress out a bit. So,
I think you're right about that. Knowing, because we know more now, there's more information. We used to know stuff when I was a kid, like that you'd be like, oh, there's a war in this place. But you were kind of like, oh, okay. But now you're being told that you have to be aware of everything and you have to have an opinion on it, and it has to be the right opinion. And that's not helping people either, is it? Because it's like, I can't do anything about fighting in Uganda. I don't want it to happen. Of course I don't. I don't want any war anywhere. I think it's ludicrous that we're still fighting anywhere and disagreeing over whatever. But I can't change it. And me being aware of it and having an opinion on it doesn't change it.
Totally. And that's a big part of, like, the brain. Human brain is really all about, it loves control. And it's any sense of control. And you can sort of see that. That's why social media can be so popular, as in, yes, there's people out there I don't like, but I can block them, I can mute them, I am going to be friends with them, I can just seek out people that I want to talk to.
Yes.
And that's, the brain likes that. It feels good about that, because it's like, oh, this is good. That means I don't get to have any stresses. But any sense of control we can impart on ourselves is something the brain tends to embrace. Like, you can have, your life can be completely going down the tubes, but you think, well, I'm going to start this new thing. I'm going to try this new diet. I'm going to stick to it. And you feel sort of better, because...
Yes.
Even if in practical terms you're not really doing anything useful, or which is not really improving the situation, you feel like, I made a decision I can do this now. This is my choice. I'm in control of my life. Even if it's like ordering an elaborate coffee in Starbucks, you feel like, yeah, I want a double tall mug of chocolate whipped. I don't go to Starbucks. I don't know what they sell. Or I'm not a coffee guy, so I just know that's a common refrain. So the sense of control you have. But when something stressful happens and you can't control it, you feel a sort of sense of impotency, and it does make you feel like thwarted, and it makes you feel even more stressed. So this bad thing is happening, suck it up. And, you know, like say there's a war in Uganda, you should be sad about that. What can I do about it? Nothing. Just be sad. That's not helpful. And again, I do wonder if that's a lot of time where the whole thoughts and prayers things come from, in that bad thing has happened. I feel like I want to do something, but, you know, not in a way which actually causes me to invest or lose anything, so I'll send thoughts and prayers. I helped. And, you know, again, I'm not saying everyone who does it has that in mind, but I imagine that's a big part of it. You know, this illusion of control, of influence and events can be very tempting, because without it, you just feel more stressed. But then you feel like a bad person for ignoring it. So
yes,
it's like you're damned anyway you look, really.
Well, this is it, isn't it? And you see everybody shouting and hollering at each other, and you're like, well, this isn't sorting it out either. I'm aware of it. I don't want people to be getting killed for whatever reason they're getting killed, and I can't change it. And I've got shit I've got to deal with in my own life. But then you feel guilty because of that. You go, but my car's knackered and I've got to worry about that, or my kids need something, or my whatever. And then you feel, but then it's like, yeah, but I should be worrying about this atrocity that's going on in this other place. And it's not because I don't care about it. You know, this is why everyone's stressing out, because you don't know what to do, and you feel like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the human brain has a very strong capacity to care, and we do care about loads of things, and we are a very considerate species. I know, like, any look at the news or any glance at Twitter makes you think otherwise, but in terms of, like, other species, we are, by many measures, the most social, the most friendly, because we can put up with each other better than any other species can. And, like, our closest relatives are chimps, perhaps. And so, like, you can have, like, say you go into a comedy gig and there are, like, 100 people in the room and just sat there just looking at something. Now, if you replace those people with chimps, like, within an hour, they'd be blood everywhere, be shit on the walls, because, I mean, again, Jonglers have closed down.
I've done that gig.
that's Blangarrow again. But, you know, chimps can't do that. They don't tolerate each other well. They can have a certain size group of chimps, and beyond that, they get freaked out because there's too many. Mm. Whereas we can live in, like, cities like London, which is so densely populated in terms of how big we are. Like, insects can't handle that much, you know, each other on top of each other, and to that degree in most cases. Mm. So we are the most tolerant species in terms of raw numbers. You know, we don't tolerate each other perfectly, but we can just, other people being around doesn't bother us like it would other species. So we are incredibly social in that respect. But, you know, so there's a default caring about other people just generally. And it's a bad thing. I don't want other people in different countries to be dying and killing each other. That's awful. But, you know, beyond that, you haven't got any real investment or grounded in that issue. Like, I don't know these people. I don't know where they are or what they're fighting over. You can't really, there's nothing tangible to cling on to beyond just the raw details. But then people will latch onto that. As in, like, again, I used to write for The Guardian a lot, and they'd tweet out the articles. And I was the jester of the science section, I suppose.
Right.
And I write about frivolous stuff. Just put a scientific spin on something which shouldn't have a scientific spin, just for laughs, because I just find that funny.
It's funny,
doing comedy. And if you go out on the main Guardian Twitter account, and you get so many comments and replies going, God, I can't be writing about this. You know, there are more important things like drought, like environmental concerns. Yeah, yeah. But that argument can be applied to anything. As in, like, technically then, there's one most important story in the world which everyone should be covering and nothing else. And when that's sorted out, then we should then default to the next one.
Yeah.
And then, like, so that's not how media works, that's not how news, that's not how people work. We cannot care about only one thing or one thing only at the expense of everything else. And expecting people to do that is kind of, you know, it's unrealistic. You might care about that. You might care about it greatly for good reason. Mm. But I'm not you, and I don't know why you care about it, and I don't have the same investment as you do. And that's something that's, you know, you lose that a lot in online interactions, but it's still it's still a valid point and still something which should be addressed more than it is.
Yes, absolutely. And do you think you use humour to cope with it? I know I do. I know my missus has said, my various relationships have said, oh, do you know what? Just have a day off. You're always taking the piss, or you're always making a joke out of something. It's just how I cope.
Totally, yeah. It's a very common thing. And I think it seems to be more of a male thing than a female thing, in that, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. My father died, went to the funeral, and it was obviously one of the worst days of my life ever. But yeah. I didn't cry until I got home and my wife was in bed and a couple of glasses of wine. Then it finally came out.
Yeah.
And you know, on the day of the funeral afterwards, my uncles were just joking about the old times and stuff. And beforehand, like I didn't, like when I was there, my sisters, my stepmother and stuff, they were all crying, and rightly so. It was a horrible, devastating day. But I couldn't, and it wasn't a macho thing even. Like I wanted to. I felt I had every right to cry about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I should have done. And I wanted to. I felt like, no, why aren't I crying right now?
Mm.
And it was later on in the day I managed to do it when I was on my own. And I realised that the whole male thing of, we have to be stoic. We cannot show emotions. Yes. We have to just take the piss and josh and make laughs about stuff. That goes a lot deeper than I even realised. Because if anyone knows how unhealthy that is, it's me. Like I've done 20 years of neuroscience now, and I've worked in psychiatry and psychology, and I know the importance of emotional expression. I know how unhealthy it is and unhelpful and potentially damaging it is just to bottle that up. But even knowing all that, I still couldn't do it until I was in just the right sort of situation when no one else was around.
Mm.
So this programming goes in really deep. It's a cultural thing, like this idea that men are strong. But
yes.
Strong doesn't mean lifting stuff now. It doesn't mean sort of fighting bears. It means suppressing all emotions. And that's a really unhealthy thing to have occurred. But even when you know that on a conscious level, it seems something which is a lot harder to work around than just knowing it. Because, like I say, I went through the whole grief process in the worst possible way. And I'm a neuroscientist with psychiatry training, so you'd think I would be able to handle it. And arguably I did handle it, because I at no point do I think I was mentally compromised to the point where I needed therapy or help. But I still maintain my everyday functioning, but it cost me. It cost me a lot.
Mm.
But, you know, so I sort of describe it as, yes, it helped being the brain neuroscience guy who knows how this stuff works when I was going through it myself. But it's also kind of like being a mechanic trapped in a car with no brakes, in that, yeah, I know what the problem is, but I can't do anything about it until I got to the other side of this, because I'm stuck in here nonetheless. You know, my awareness isn't really helping me. I've got to ride it out and find out what the problem is later on, and maybe if it happens again, then I'll know better next time. And I'm trying to be more emotionally open. I want to be. It's not like it's any lack of motivation on my part, but it doesn't come naturally.
No.
I think that was the thing. I mentioned this on International Men's Day. It wasn't too long ago. And when that happens, obviously, I'm not the first to notice that men are more reticent to be openly emotional and to share things. And that's a big problem. It's in my book as well. I talked to Guy Kelly about it, and he's like very open about this. He's done shows about the lack of male emotional openness. I'm lucky that I have several good male friends who I can be like this with. It's always still a struggle,
yes.
But you can do it with them. And it's me and my mate Simon, we've known each other since we were two, so
he's
essentially my brother, and I can tell him anything I want about this.
Yeah,
sort of
stuff. I feel like Tom, since I was three. Yeah, yeah, same.
Yeah, but even then, like, could I cry in front of him? I could, but you know, we neither of us would enjoy it, and it would be like really weird.
Yeah,
but so I'm trying to be more open about it, but it's hard in that the International Men's Day thing. People, mostly women, I think, were saying, guys, it's okay to talk. You can talk to me. I'm right here if you want anything, which I really appreciated.
Mm.
But it's not that just having the opportunity isn't the end of the story. It's like, yes, I know I could talk to if I wanted to, but that still means I have to sum up the ability or force myself to do it. And that's a bigger hurdle than I think people realise, in that I would love to be able to talk to a female friend about all that I've gone through. I mean, this is actually really helpful to me. Like, I can talk about this now openly because this is a good place for it. But when someone says to me, hey, if you want to talk, I'm right here. Like, people said, they said that to me a lot. But I know you are, and I know I have permission. I know you wouldn't mind if I did, but there's still a mental block here.
Yes.
There's still a mental hurdle, which I'm not ready to leap over yet.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
And I don't know why that's there. And I don't know what to do about it, and I'm trying, but it's not a case of, you know, the reason I don't open up more is not because of lack of opportunity, it's because of lack of ability. It's not been something I've ever done before in any meaningful way, and that takes time and practice to get over that.
Do you think it's the fear of looking silly, the shame? Maybe it's that.
Maybe on a subconscious level, because I don't feel ashamed. I think, you know, I'm ashamed that I couldn't. That's what was perhaps the most annoying part of it for me, is in that, like, the day my father died, I cried that evening. I cried when I was on the phone saying goodbye to him. But not very long, because he was being held up by an intensive care doctor. So I was saying goodbye to my father. I was saying the last words I would ever say to him. And I had like 20 minutes notice to do this because I didn't know he was going to make it through the morning. I was in my kitchen in my pajamas. It was not how I wanted to do this, but it was this or nothing. And I had to go through that. And I was obviously in tears about saying,
of course,
all he'd done for me. It only took about 5 minutes because what do you say, you know? But then afterwards, I mean, the doctor's listening to me, and I don't want to embarrass myself in front of him. He's an intensive care doctor. I mean, what has he seen that I could possibly shock him? You'd be surprising to the guy. And okay, he was wonderful. He was great and everything. No disrespect to that guy. But so I cried then, and I cried the day he died. That evening, I was out with my kids when I got the call. And I thought, well, I can't, because they're 8 and 5. And I'm not, I know it's a stoic thing, but I'm not dumping my grief on them as well in the middle of a pandemic when they're terrified and they've just lost their grandfather. I just couldn't do it. Got that was a big part of it too. And it was that evening. Then my wife was obviously sat next to me, and she was crying too. Then I felt bad because I was making her cry, even though she was crying because she lost her father-in-law. But I felt bad because I was, I'm upset with my wife now. I was like, Dean, you have every right to be upset right now. This
absolutely
is not. But that part in my mind just couldn't stop. It couldn't stop trying to find reasons not to cry, or trying to find don't do that because you've got to maintain an even keel because of this. It's really hard to shut off that manly voice in your head saying, come on now. It's programmed in from day one, and it's not something you can get over without much effort.
It sounds like that control thing that you mentioned earlier.
Totally, yeah. That's a real big part of it. It's in, again, men love control. Like, we are supposed to be the big, strong ones. And for all that's, it's a nonsense stereotype. I mean, men are just as emotional as women in the neurological sense. There's no disparity in what we feel and how we feel it. Just we are discouraged from ever showing it, and that's really dangerous and really unhelpful. And, I mean, stereotypes infect mental health care a lot. I mean, you've heard of nymphomania, I assume?
Yes, absolutely.
Have you heard of satyriasis?
No.
That's the male equivalent. Nymphomania is only women. Satyriasis is like, these days, it's just called hypersexuality. There's no differentiation between the genders. But the thing is, nymphomania caught on. It's like, what's the thing? Women who like sex, can you imagine?
Yeah.
A man who wants lots of sex, that's Tuesday. That's not a thing. So these cultural stereotypes just become, they manifest in really weird ways. But the one about men not being openly emotional or not being able to is, it's a really harmful one. More mental health patients are women than men. Women have high rates of depression, have high rates of anxiety. the obvious assumption is, women are more vulnerable to mental health problems. But suicide is the biggest killer of men under 35.
Yes.
So is it more a case of women are just more able to admit that they have these issues and these problems, whereas men will actually just suck it up and soldier on way beyond the point where they should? Which leads to the worst possible outcome, and then they can't cope anymore and they take their own lives as a result. And can you say that's not the case? I genuinely can't. Guys will not admit that they have problems or they're struggling, because that isn't what men do, but it should be. But saying that and achieving that, as it turns out, as I found, very different things.
Absolutely. Well, it's having those channels open, isn't it? Like you said, it's all very well us reaching out saying, I need to talk, but then people have got ready to receive it as well. I've said that before, where I've said to people, like, ask people how they are, but remember to listen to the answer, or wait for the answer.
That's a really big part of it too.
I
had that. Again, it's such a, my brain is sabotaging me all the time. And I had that people saying, how are you? And they're still saying it now. How are you? Are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm all right. Because, I mean, maybe at the time when they ask me, I am.
Yeah.
Like, lately, I feel all right. But then, that weird thing where you, I feel bad for feeling all right because I've lost a parent.
Mm.
And also my grandmother died before my birthday. So it's been a double whammy this year, which is nice.
So sorry.
I know, man. It's been a horrible 2020, but it's nice to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, but it's that thing of, like you were saying about how you're like, well, I'm supposed to feel this. I'm supposed to do that.
Yeah, and that has issues of its own. Like the idea that you have to, or you should feel this way. Like the idea of men shouldn't react emotionally to stuff is bad, but emotions are complex. They're confusing. Like this whole five stages of grief model that people always refer to. That, you know, was it denial, anger, fear, bargaining, acceptance? Mm. That's a sort of mainstream thing now. But even the psychiatrist who originated it, she never said everyone would do the exact same stages at the exact same way, or even experience them all. But that seems to be how we've, you know, it's become simplified in modern culture. But it's not that. It's any emotional reaction from a really powerful experience is going to be really complex and individual and subjective and variable. And that's good. That's how the brain works. But, you know, I've also had to try and let go of this idea that I should be reacting like this. This is how I should be doing
it. Yeah.
A lot of the time it's a case of, well, is this right for you right now? Would doing anything different be a challenge for you? Would it be stressful? Would it feel bad if you, would you feel bad about not doing what you're doing? And take all that into account as well. So like if someone needs time and space, if someone needs to pretend they're okay, there's also something to be said for that as well. So
yeah,
it's really complex and, you know, everyone will have their own take on it. And that's something to keep in mind as well.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I would take from it is that, yeah, it's horrible that you've lost your dad, and in the way that you did as well, and your grandmother, and but the things you've achieved, that's because I've got sons and they've achieved so much, and I'm so proud of them, and I'm like it's made me feel that everything I've been through, be it self-inflicted or whatever, and all the work I've put in they're like my reward. It's like they've achieved stuff. I'm like that's made it all worthwhile.
Oh yeah, I totally get that. I mean, I don't think either my father or my grandmother would have said I wasted my life.
No, of course not.
There's nothing like that. But the legacy thing, and like I don't think they would ever, either of them would have said they didn't achieve much or they weren't proud of their children. They know they were. They always said so. But again, it's not really about them now. It's about us, you know, the ones who are left, and how you feel. Again, people say to, like, just focus on the good memories, and like, but that's not how. Again, that's not how the brain works now. In that, I have loads of good memories about my father, and my grandmother, but immediately after they died, those memories were now painful because they're not just a fun time I had with my grandmother, my father. They're now a fun time I had with my father, who is dead now, who just died. And like, so, cause every memory connects to every other in a way.
Yes.
And it's kind of hard to sort of get around that. I mean, over time, things fade. Like the brain's good at that. There's the fading affect bias. Negative emotional memories fade faster than positive ones, which is why the old days can seem so much more better than they actually were at the time. Yeah, which is why people always say school days, best days of your life, which is a phrase I hate.
Bullshit.
I think, maybe for you, mate, but I got plans.
Yeah. That's excellent. That's excellent what you just said.
Yeah. Maybe you peaked early, but don't write me off just yet.
Yeah, but you were the king of the school and I wasn't. I was happy to move on.
Yeah, so...
I see. Yeah.
So it's a thing like that. But so like the brain has defense mechanisms for this sort of thing. But in the moment, when it's just happened, it's going to be raw. It's going to be painful. And people will try to help. And God bless them for that. It's great. But it's also, you don't know how to help someone in that. I had people tell me, wish me lots of messages from people who knew what I was going through, knew what I experienced, were horrified on my behalf, and saying things like, God, I'm so sorry. I wish there was something I could do. And a lot of the time, it just made me angry.
Right.
And I know that's not fair, and I know that's illogical and irrational, but the fact was, I was seeing it as, I wish there was something I could do. It was like, yeah, but there isn't. It's a lockdown. My father's died. What can you do about that? You're just making yourself feel better. Screw you. And I mean, I just thought, I never said this. I just thought this.
Yeah.
I want to clarify. I never lost like my, I never actually had a full breakdown.
I was just kicking off. Right, mate, I'm just saying.
Going outside yelling at pigeons and stuff. All of that would have been cathartic, I suppose. But my emotional state wasn't really conducive to that sort of intervention then. Now it is. It'd be great now, like, for them to say, let me help. Well, yeah, if you can do this. And eventually I was saying to friends, like, can you get some shopping for us? Because I really don't feel like going out. And
yeah.
And it was obviously mid-pandemic and stuff. So, yeah, but, you know, your emotional state will change. That's not even a grief thing. That's just an everyday thing.
Mm, yes.
If someone says, like, hey, do you want to talk? And they say no. Okay. But maybe tomorrow they'll want to. And, you know, then if you keep asking them and they keep saying, no, go away, then you're annoying them. So it's really hard to pin down. It's like, it's such a minefield.
It is, isn't it? And it all depends on where you're at that moment, that given moment, doesn't it? Like you've said, this has been brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on.
That's been great, man.
I've really enjoyed it.
To be honest.
Sorry?
really cathartic to be able to talk about this.
This is why we do it. It's a safe space to cut loose and talk about the things that maybe you can't in other places, and you know, and I've wanted to have spoken with you. It's been an absolute joy. Do you have any not advice? Is there anything, I don't know, sort of anything that people can do to, like, I don't know, not brain exercise, but I don't really know, just something that, do you have any advice for anyone, just sort of like,
I think
the advice is dangerous. I know that.
Yeah. Look, I've had so many people think my books are self-help books, and they're not. And I'm very, very wary of the whole self-help industry. In that, I get why people like it. I get why it appeals, and I get like, it can be quite helpful. But
people looking for answers, aren't they?
Yeah. And it's the people who say, "I have all the answers. No matter who you are, no matter what's going on in your life, I will fix you. Just give me some money."
Yeah. That's always like, money, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, all right. That's what I'm like. Okay. Now that's a bold claim, and you cannot live up to it, because I know that's not how any brain works, and so on. So I'm always very wary of, you know, venturing into the self-help field. But I think just awareness. I mean, everything I've written comes down to that, really. All my books, my output, my just trying to enhance like, people's understanding of what's going on inside their head, like in terms of, you know, why is this happening to me? Why is this going on? What's going on neurologically? Just give it a tangible basis to say, right, I'm experiencing this. Why? This is weird. What's going on there? Like, oh, okay. So because of this happened, then this went on in my amygdala and this caused this reaction. Or it's an enhanced stress response because of X, Y, Z. That can give it a certain sort of, it can ground it a bit. I mean, a lot of therapies are based on that, like feedback or biofeedback or neurofeedback, where if you're having an anxious episode, they hook you up to like heart monitors or blood pressure monitors or even like a new brainwave readout, and they say, don't try and suppress the anxious feelings. Try and like get this line down to the normal level. Try and get this beeping line reduced. And so focus on that. And it sort of, you know, gives it a more, makes it graspable, makes something your brain can cling to and hang on to and sort of lower the levels. And then, you know, it becomes, it sort of like skips the problem and goes straight to the, you know, or it gives it a sort of different sheen, or it gives it a different form, and that can be really helpful. Sort of a sense of, again, back to the sense of control. So, you know, if you have any way to sort of enhance your understanding of what's going on inside your head when you're actually experiencing these things, that can be really helpful. So what I've done there is basically in a really long-winded way of plugging my own books. Should you wish to buy them, they're all out there now. So.
Yes, because you've got a new one coming out, Psychological.
Psychological.
When does that come out?
That comes out February 4th.
February 4th?
That's all about stuff I've talked about today, and it's basically my everything I know about mental health in terms of what's going on in the brain and stuff. Like all the stuff on neurotransmitters and ketamine, that's all in there. So,
excellent.
Feel free to peruse.
Brilliant. I'm looking forward to reading it thoroughly. I've skimmed through it, but I'm going to read it properly. And your other books are available?
Everywhere, really. You go to my site, deanburnett.com. You can see the links there, or just put up on Amazon. He's got The Idiot Brain, The Happy Brain, and Why Your Parents Are Driving You Up the Wall and What to Do About It. Very long title, but it's for teenagers. So.
Excellent.
I'm out there if you need me for anything. I'm always happy to answer questions about stuff. I'm on Twitter as @GaruBoy, as we said.
Yep.
So brilliant. You can find me if you need me. I'm always happy to help out if anyone has any issues.
Fantastic. And are you okay? Because you've really opened up on this episode.
Yeah,
and I don't want to just go, thanks, mate, bye, you know, and just leave you sat in your kitchen spinning.
I am, genuinely. And I was okay before we started, but I feel better now. And that's, again, another bit of advice. If you can do stuff like this, if you can just tell someone in a good context what you've gone through and what you're feeling, that is really helpful sometimes.
Absolutely. That's
essentially the basis of therapy, really, isn't it? And someone who is willing to listen to you, tell them exactly what you're going through, what you experience, what you're feeling. You can't really measure how useful that is.
No.
It's really, really quite significant.
I've been terrible at that recently. I've said this, I think, on other episodes where I'm always encouraging people to reach out, open up, send me a message if you want to, and blah, blah, blah. But then I realised I was shutting down from people. I wasn't speaking to people. Like I say, like with you, I hadn't replied to you. I forgot to reply to you because I'd just shut off. And it doesn't have to be ringing up or messaging your friend about mental health, just a conversation.
Yeah, like we are a social species first and foremost, and we thrive on interaction and engagement, which is why lockdown has been so hard for so many people, and why social media has gone from like being the big bad to godsend, and that we can't do without it. You know, solitary confinement in prison is literally recognized as a form of torture.
Wow.
It is that. We cannot cope with complete isolation. Well, some people can. Obviously, you get your hermits, you get your wise men, but they go quite bonkers quite quickly.
There's a fine line, isn't there, between being wise and not
being
so wise. But this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
You too, man.
And,
appreciate it.
We will stay in touch, I promise, because this is...
Absolutely.
It's been fantastic. Thank
Great
you.
Stuff. You do good work, man. Really appreciate it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.